And I want to welcome you to Moscow, where today the people, as you can see right there, those people are in big economic trouble. Look at them. You feel bad for them. They're on the verge of not even being able to buy any gasoline. And if they do go to buy gasoline, they're going to be waiting in line for hours and hours, because this place, Moscow, Russia, it's nothing more than a paper tiger. I welcome you to the paper tiger. And what do you say we give those words that I just read the Sanchez effect? Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. In case you don't know, and I'm sure you probably do because you probably watch us every day as you did yesterday, but in case you don't, nothing could be less true about Moscow than the words that I just read to you. Those are President Trump's words about Moscow and about Russia. It was kind of weird to hear Mr. Trump play this, what we called when we were little kids, the opposite game, because Moscow is the opposite, literally the opposite of everything that he said. There are no lines in gas stations. Nope, yet. There's also no crime to speak of. Sure, like, nobody here likes the war, but most of the country also understands why it's being fought. So why would Mr. Trump, a man whose words violate his own stated intentions in the past, why would he say something like this? Ah, this is the proverbial $60,000 question, as we say in America. You know what I believe? And I told you this yesterday. Remember the show we did yesterday? It has to do with Mr. Trump's penchant for needing to be in the headlines at all costs, which is why he says crazy things that most of the time he doesn't even mean or believe. See, that's my take. And I'll talk more about that a little bit later. But first, what I want to give you now is some of the other takes. First, of course, what we want to do is we want to start by sharing with you once again, in case you don't remember, in case you didn't hear it, what Mr. Trump actually said that is causing whiplash all over the world. Here it is. I'm going to read it to you. He says, after getting to know and fully understand the Ukraine-Russia military and economic situation and, comma, after seeing the economic trouble that it is causing Russia, I think Ukraine, with the support of the European Union, is in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form. That's what he said. By the way, I could read you the whole thing, but it gets a little boring. He then goes on to talk about Russia being weak, a paper tiger, and a lot more. Everybody's poor. They're going to be in gas lines, no gas, which sent people in Russia and around the world, after they heard Mr. Trump's words, scurrying for a proper response. So that's what I want to do today. I want to give you a sense of what people are saying after they heard this. And I want to go through some of them, and we're going to start with the official Russia response, which I actually thought was pretty good, because usually these diplomats are a little on the boring side. This particular Russian diplomat at the United Nations aims what he's saying not so much at Mr. Trump, but he aims it instead at the man who planted these thoughts in Mr. Trump's head. Let's hear him.
It is extremely regrettable that Security Council members are forced to waste their time today attending a meeting initiated by our European colleagues solely for the New York tour of a well-known former actor. For this occasion, they are packed here like a subway at rush hour, and every speech we have heard and will hear is simply a rehash of the previous ones and bears no relation to the truth. Our meeting, of course, will bring no added value to the cause of establishing peace in Ukraine and will be nothing more than another shameful episode in the hypocrisy fair that is the presentation of the Ukrainian issue by European states. The European sponsors of the Zelensky regime want the UN Security Council to live, like them, in some parallel reality in which Ukraine does not lose in the battlefield, losing city after city, and Ukrainian citizens line up to die in a senseless meat grinder for Western geopolitical interests. In this distorted picture they are trying to force upon us today, Ukraine is an island of a democracy and freedom, and its usurper leader, who broke all his campaign promises and imprisoned thousands of his fellow citizens, enjoys the support of all Ukrainians, who, they say, don't even see the need for elections, since they have such a wonderful president.
Okay, so that's Russia's envoy to the United Nations. Pretty well-written delivery, right? And his response seems it's right, it's proper, and it's corrective, almost as if to say, what in the hell are you talking about? Which is frankly and fairly what a lot of people thought. But then again, he uses the opportunity to reveal some truths that European elites in particular don't want to hear, or maybe they just truly don't believe it. But again, that's the Russian envoy. He's supposed to say those things. So let's listen to some other important people, I think, who I think have a lot of credibility, at least with me. Let's turn now to the supposed originator of the Trump message, because I'd like you to hear what Doug McGregor says. Now, see, I got to tell you, I think Doug McGregor is a very, very smart man, probably one of the smartest. He has a very different take on this, and he talks in particular about what Mr. Trump said regarding the fact that he thinks that somehow Ukraine can still win this war with Zelensky as its commander. Here's Doug McGregor.
I think Zelensky's desperate. He'll do anything for attention, to attract attention, to attract money, anything he possibly can. He reminds me of Trotsky back in 1920, before the decision was made by the Bolsheviks to invade Poland. He predicted the imminent destruction of Poland and unification with their fellow communists in Germany. Well, ultimately, Trotsky was wrong. Poland won the war. The Bolsheviks were driven back in confusion, and Trotsky eventually woke up with an axe in his head. I think something similar probably awaits our friend Zelensky. So these are all acts or expressions of desperation now.
By the way, that man you just heard right there has forgotten more about military matters than most people in the world know. That's how much respect I have for him. I speak to him often, and I have been doing so for many years. In the end, by the way, what many are trying to do is just figure out why Trump did this about face out of the blue. Some say it's because he just wants to make money by selling his old weapons to the Europeans, who seem hell-bent on going to war with Russia through Ukraine, to which Trump is saying, fine, go, have at it. You want to fight the Russians? Go fight the Russians. But I'm not going to join you. That's partly correct, by the way. In fact, John Mearsheimer, another man I think is very smart, says that while everybody is focusing on what Trump said, what really matters is what he did not say. What Trump did not say, according to Mearsheimer, Trump simply talked tough on Russia to disguise the fact that he has no intentions of taking on Russia or helping Ukraine. The Europeans want Trump to back them, but he's not going to, and he didn't. They want him to add new sanctions to Russia. He didn't. Did you notice he didn't say that at all in his statement? That's important. So what he offered instead of all those things, which is what people want him to do and say, is just tough talk. Tough talk. Which, by the way, that tough talk, it still leaves Ukraine in a very bad place.
When the United States was operating in Ukraine under Joe Biden, we had the pedal to the metal. We were doing a great deal to help Ukraine win the war. And Ukraine could not win the war with all that European support and all that American support. Well, once the Americans under Trump begin to backtrack and shift the burden onto the Europeans, who have huge economic problems of their own, how can anyone possibly make the argument that Europe plus Ukraine can do what Europe plus the United States plus Ukraine could not do? And the answer is they can't. What are they going to do? Launch another offensive like the one they launched on June 4th of 2023? I don't think so. I mean, that's not going to work. The Ukrainians have no military option here.
Professor John Mearsheimer, and that's a reality check. That's a reality check that he just delivered. Now, if the U.S. is really out when it comes to Ukraine, and they're leaving it all up to the Europeans, what does that really say? Let's go back to my friend Colonel Doug McGregor, because his explanation is really about something that's happening right now in the world to the United States, my country, as well as in Europe. And this is purely economic. Let's take a listen.
Economic situation in Europe, the financial structure is ready to collapse. You know, we're in bad shape. You know, de-dollarization continues around the world because many countries are wisely distancing themselves from us because they anticipate a spike in the bond market. You know, we've already been buying our own bonds for months and months and months. And the 10-year bond continues to inch upward, as all the bonds do. If it gets closer to 5%, then I think we're in a lot of trouble, because that has a huge impact on the trillion-plus dollar interest payment that we're now stuck with. And we have a $7 trillion budget, which is outrageous, over $1 million of which is devoted to defense. Probably another $200-400 billion go into the black ops and CIA and national security agency budgets. So you're looking at $1.5 trillion that's all bound up with the warfare state. All of this is going to come tumbling down.
Come tumbling down, he says, tumbling down because of the warfare state. Now, these are truths. These are truths you're not going to hear if you're watching CNN or the BBC or any of those other clowns. Joining us now to talk a lot more about this is Danielle Ganzer. He's a historian, he's a publicist, and he teaches critical thinking, which I find particularly weird for a European, given how the attribute seems to be in short supply there these days among its leaders. Professor, thanks for joining us. I hope you don't take offense to my comment, but, you know, let me say this. Present company excluded. How's that?
Thanks a lot for inviting me. And yeah, critical thinking is at the moment not widespread in Europe.
Why is Europe going through this deficiency at the time? And why are they so hell-bent, it seems, on continuing their aggression against Russia, or at least their stated aggression?
I think they just, you know, are locked in a trajectory. Like they thought, yeah, the United States wants to fight Russia. And now that the United States says, oh, we're not going to continue this fight, they have a problem to stop it. So that's basically Germany with Bundeskanzler Friedrich Merz. And it's France with Macron. And it's Great Britain with Keir Starmer. But you know, it might just take a little longer until they realize that it's better to settle the conflict along the lines that Pete Hegseth actually said in February 2025. Pete Hegseth, U.S. defense minister or war minister, said in Brussels in February 2025 that Ukraine will not join NATO and the territory lost to Russia will not, you know, be regained. And I think that's still true today.
So you agree then with Mearsheimer and you agree with Doug McGregor when they say it's a travesty to think that Ukraine can do now what they couldn't do when Biden was giving them everything that they asked for?
Yes, I do think it's much more important to listen to people like John Mearsheimer, who I greatly respect, or Jeffrey Sachs or Doug McGregor. These three gentlemen are much more consistent in what they say than Donald Trump. So really, if somebody has an hour to spend, it's better to listen to Mearsheimer than to Trump.
There are some voices in Europe. They don't get all the attention, but there are some voices, members of specific parties in Germany, I'm thinking of, some in the UK, and certainly Le Pen and others who are creating a resistance movement or have created a resistance movement for Macron. Obviously, Hungary has been speaking out against the foolishness, as he calls it, of the EU and NATO, as Slovakia has done the same thing. And today we're hearing kind of a voice that I didn't expect to hear say this, but listen real quick to what Donald Tusk says. He's the prime minister of Poland, and I want to get your reaction on the other side. Play this if we could, Andre.
President Trump has stated that Ukraine could, with the support of the European Union, regain all of its territory. This surprising optimism conceals a promise of reduced US involvement and a shift of responsibility for ending the war to Europe. Truth is better than illusion.
So essentially what he said, pardon me, I thought you would be able to hear it, but I'll explain it to you. He's basically, and this is Polish prime minister, by the way, the same guy who's been saying that there's tons of drones that are suddenly landing in his country and talking tough as if he was ready to go to war with Russia. Now, in that soundbite that I just played, he seems to be saying it's ridiculous to think that the Europeans could actually go to war with Ukraine, with Russia, fighting through Ukraine, and that Ukraine is in any way winning that war. I was surprised that he would say that because, like we're saying, Trump kind of has had a whiplash comment. This sounds almost like a little bit of a whiplash comment to me, too. Does it mean that the Europeans are now starting to see the light?
I think some do, yes. I mean, you said rightly that Viktor Orban, already for a long time, the Hungarians, you know, have traveled to Moscow, have traveled to Washington, have even traveled to China and have said, you know, we have to stop this war. And then obviously Hungary and Viktor Orban were, you know, criticized from the bigger European players like Germany, France, and Great Britain. But keep in mind that Poland, I think, doesn't want this war to sort of escalate into all directions because Poland is very close, obviously, to the war theater. And furthermore, it's also important to record that in 2008, when US President George Bush, you know, came to Romania and at the NATO summit said, you know, we want to invite Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO. That was in 2008. And for me as a historian, you know, that actually, you know, started the war because that's the whole problem that we're looking at. At that time, even in Germany, Chancellor Merkel, Angela Merkel was then chancellor. She said, you know, it's not a good idea to invite Ukraine into NATO. So there are people in Germany and above all the population who don't want at all a confrontation with Russia. They don't want to, you know, go as German soldiers to fight in Ukraine. I mean, they just don't want to do that. It's just the government in Germany with Bundeskanzler Friedrich Merz, who is, you know, he's making comments like, you know, if Ukraine is defeated by Russia, then Russia will attack another country, and after that country, it will be us. You know, Russia will attack Germany. And he's made that comment in August. It's, you know, beyond belief.
You know, Tucker Carlson, interestingly enough, said today that whole drone story over Poland is a false flag. Do you agree?
I haven't checked the data, but I think Tucker Carlson is one of the most courageous journalists that you have over there in the United States, and Seymour Hersh as well is very interesting. Mm. So it's possible that we have a false flag. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964,
yes,
which started the Vietnam War, was a lie. I mean, it's in the context of wars, it's always very important to check for lies. So yeah, let's follow the data and see where it leads. I think it's important that Tucker Carlson brings up the subject.
Let me give you another one. The Iraqi soldiers on orders from Saddam Hussein were going into Kuwaiti hospitals, going into incubators, taking babies and then crushing their skulls on the ground. That was the actual story given to the American people to make them go to the Gulf War. It was a lie. It was fabricated by a marketing company that was paid hundreds and thousands of dollars to create this movie for the American people.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, that was in August 1990, you know, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait.
Yeah.
I have it in my book, actually, on Ruthless Empire. And it was Hill & Knowlton was the company that created the story. And what you had at the time was a girl, you know, a teenage girl who said, I worked at the hospital in Kuwait and the American soldiers the Iraqi soldiers did not only invade Kuwait, they also came to the hospital, as you correctly said, and they took the incubators and left the babies, I mean, you know, on the floor to die. And later it was revealed that girl with the name Naira was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She was never at that hospital. So yes, war lies. And we also have the story with the weapons of mass destruction of Colin Powell in 2003 yeah. when he went to the UN Security Council. And, you know, but I think more and more people are waking up to the fact that there are war lies.
The whole history of wars has always been based, not always, obviously, you know, the Nazis really did invade Norway, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I can even go back because I happen to be from that part of the world. I was born in Cuba, as you may know. And if you go back to the Spanish-American War, which was when the United States started to get its preeminence as a military aggressor, that also was created when the United States, for need of a war, put a bomb on a ship off the coast of Havana, blew it up, and then said it was the Spanish who did it so that they could go to war with the Spanish.
Yeah, USS Maine.
Yes.
USS Maine. Many people don't recall that this actually happened, but as you correctly said, there was an American ship harboring, you know, in the port of Havana. It was 1898. And then, you know, suddenly the ship explodes and the American press then blames, you know, the Spanish for it because Cuba was a Spanish colony at the time. And in order to pick a fight, they had to blame Spanish for something. And the Spanish were not going to bomb Florida or Washington or any other part of the United States. So that's another trick you can do. I mean, you can go with your ship, put it on the dock of the harbor and blow it up and then say the other one did it. It's called false flag. And, you know, while we're talking about it, I mean, Kiev, 20 February 2014,
yep.
when Yanukovych was overthrown, we had snipers shooting from Hotel Ukraine and we had snipers shooting from the conservatorium. So, and I think Ivan Katkanovsky has done excellent research on that. I think he's based in Canada, and he basically said this was a false flag. You know, it was then blamed on then Ukrainian President Yanukovych that he killed, you know, his own population, but it's not true. It's basically, if you look at the data now, absolutely clear that this was the protest movement. They shot their own protesters plus Berkut policemen. And still is, you know, I'm based here in Switzerland. And then when I say this publicly, and I do, you know, I give public talks also in Germany, and I say this was a false flag in 2014, which started the Ukrainian war. People still can't believe it. It's still, what can I say?
Why is that? I'm always, you know, I was vacationing. Actually, my son got married in Italy. So my wife and I, we flew into Germany and, you know, did the whole, such a beautiful country. My goodness. One of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, driving through part of Germany and Switzerland and the Swiss Alps and wow. But obviously, being a journalist and being a guy who likes to talk, I would stop in all the little villages and talk to people. And
yes.
most of them still have this Russophobia and this fear. I would talk to them about things involving the United States and Russia, and they think the United States walks on water and that the CIA is a benevolent enterprise that goes around giving candy to children. And as soon as I mentioned Russia, they were like, oh my God, those are very, very bad people. How has that mindset stuck for so many years? And how is the media, or the governments, how are they so good at peripherating that?
Really, it's just the propaganda. I mean, you know, we have in Germany, in Austria, and in Switzerland, so these are German-speaking countries here, where I do my public talks, we have a lot of propaganda, and it basically says Putin is evil and the Russians are evil and they started the war in Ukraine for no reason. You know, that's that's the narrative that we've had since 24 February 2022. And I said, okay, yes, let's look at the data. The invasion of Putin into Ukraine, according to my analysis, is illegal because you cannot invade another country. Mm-hmm. But then I also point out that the US overthrow of the Yanukovych government on 20 February 2014, so 8 years before the Russian invasion, was also illegal. And you ask me, why do people judge so harshly the Russians and are very, you know, sort of supportive for the Americans. It's because they don't know that there was this overthrow of the government in 2014, because it's not being told by the German, by the Austrian, and by the Swiss press. I mean, they don't. You can hear these stories, you know, if you listen to Jeffrey Sachs or if you right. listen to Jordan Mersheimer. I mean, obviously, if you want to hear it, you can hear it. But it's just like 5% of the discourse, and 95% of the discourse is the Russians are to blame for everything. In fact, in Germany, they even have this phrase, unprovozierter Angriffskrieg, and it actually means unprovoked war of aggression. And they use this phrase every day when they speak about Russia. Like, so, you know, Lavrov is making, you know, a comment at the United Nations. So the German television reports on Lavrov, but they make sure that in the introduction they say, you know, there was an unprovoked war of aggression. And so people think, just through conditioning, mental conditioning, like Noam Chomsky explained, you know, manufacturing consent
yes.
works by just
yes.
repetition. And Noam Chomsky got it right, and we see that it works. But also keep in mind that, especially in East Germany, people don't believe it because they know that a confrontation with Russia would just be disastrous.
Well, but what about facts, though? I mean, what about comparative facts? Let's make Russia the bad. I'm going to agree that Russia is the bad guy, and Russia had no right to go into Ukraine. Okay, let's put that over here. We got that in a box. Let me give you a couple other yeah. boxes. The United States and NATO and the Germans and all the Europeans invaded Iraq and killed something like 750,000 people by some estimates. The United States yeah. and the NATO and the Germans and those people invaded Afghanistan and stayed there for 20 years. The United States and NATO and the Germans bombed Belgrade for 3 straight months and killed 1,000 some civilians who were just minding their own business. So
absolutely.
I guess, can the kettle call the pot black is what I'm asking.
No, obviously, if you look at the wars that NATO countries have carried out, like let's leave Vietnam away and let's just go to the 21st century.
Yeah.
In 2001, you're absolutely right. On 7 October 2001, the US invaded Afghanistan, and the French, you know, and the Germans and the British, even the Australians, you know, everybody just flooded Afghanistan, and they fought there for 20 years and they lost, has to be said. I mean, they lost in Afghanistan. How are they going to win in Ukraine? But okay, they lost in Afghanistan. In 2011, that's very important. You left that one out. France invaded Libya. They killed Gaddafi.
That's
and
right.
at the time, yeah, it's very important because at the time, the Chinese and the Russians gave the US an okay in the UN Security Council. But very important, they gave the okay to establish a no-fly zone, which basically means the Security Council was debating the situation at the time. Barack Obama was president of the United States, and Hillary Clinton, as you remember, was Secretary of State. So they gave them the okay to you know, have a no-fly zone. But the no-fly zone basically means that Gaddafi was not allowed to have his planes in the air. And then NATO took this and said, oh, thank you very much. We have a UN Security Council resolution to intervene in Libya. And they just bombed the country and, you know, supported the rebels, and Gaddafi was killed. And then the Russians, I mean, Putin personally, and the Chinese also, they said, Jesus Christ, what have they done with our resolution? So, you know, that was a very, very big turning point as well in 2011. So at the end, we have a lot of illegal wars that were carried out during, you know, the last 80 years. So during the time where we have this United Nations Charter. And I think the Russian invasion into Ukraine, yeah, it was illegal because, you know, like the American invasion into Iraq. But it's not only Iraq. If you take Libya or if you take Serbia, as you mentioned, in 1999, Serbia was bombed and Kosovo was split up.
Yeah,
you know, they took a part from Serbia away. And only if you have total amnesia and you say, you know, NATO never bombed the country, the US never bombed the country, yes, then you can say the invasion of Russia is illegal. So it's like 1-0 if you count the fouls. But the fouls are all over the place.
And I guess, you know what, we have to give people credit. Life is not easy. You're a historian and you're so excellent. You know all your facts at the top of your head, and it's such a delight talking to you. I get paid to know this because I'm a journalist. I'm an American journalist. I guess I'm paid to try and study the facts. So, okay, that's you, that's me. The average guy out there living in Germany, living in Switzerland, living wherever he's living in Manhattan, you know, he's got two jobs. He can barely get by. He goes home and he gets his beer and he sits in front of the TV and he watches the BBC or CNN or some idiot broadcaster who's paid by oftentimes people who want the wars to continue in some ways. And he sits in front of the TV for a half hour and that's where he gets his news. So,
I know it's hard to escape in the sense of escape these NATO narratives. But I do think you mentioned Douglas MacGregor, and you know, many people don't switch on their BBC or CNN or Fox News anymore. Yeah. What they do is they open their smartphone, and on their smartphone they open their YouTube, and their YouTube channel already has the algorithm has already, you know, Douglas MacGregor in there, or they have Jeffrey Sachs in there, or you know, they listen to people they like to listen to.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, this is a minority, but those who want to find out what's going on, they can find out. But obviously, yeah, you're right. The big narrative is Russia is to blame for everything, unless China is to blame for the rest.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the big narrative that we have in the West. And
no,
NATO is never to blame for anything.
You listen, I was doing, when I was the main anchor at CNN, filling in for Anderson Cooper during the 8 o'clock show, I was the anchor at RT, at Fox. I am an anchor at RT. I was the anchor at NBC. And just with what I'm doing now with some of the podcast and social media stuff we're doing, we're reaching something like over 1 million people a week, easily.
There you go.
Easily. Anderson Cooper would be happy to get 250,000 in the key demo these days. So you're right. Yep. There's a shift in terms
there's
of
a
where,
shift.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's, I think that's a bright outlook. You know, people understand that they've been lied to. Like just the story with the incubator. I mean, come on, you can't tell a story like that. But that was in 1990. And you and I were old enough to remember at the time in 1990, we didn't have YouTube. We didn't have any alternative channels. And I also know that in Germany, for instance, you're not allowed to watch RT. Like you're not allowed.
That's
it's like,
crazy.
You can't. But people find their ways. I just want to tell you, I mean, people find their ways. If they want to find out, they find out. And they have devices how to get to your data.
And let me ask you this, because I always ask this of my guests. Do you have any sense that what I am sharing on this network is anything other than my own thoughts as they're coming to my head as I'm having this conversation with you?
Oh, no, I think you were very well informed. I mean, you know, that's, I think you're very much like Tucker Carlson. You know, Tucker was with Fox News, so he was in the established media, and, you know, he knows the game, how it's played, and you have your experience. You know, nobody has to tell you how US media functions, but you know it firsthand.
Yeah.
So once you have this inside knowledge, like Jeff Sachs also, he has the inside knowledge how it worked when he was in Russia and when he wanted to help Boris Yeltsin and saying, okay, we need, you know, to give the Soviet Union, which just crashed down, so the newly born, reborn Russia, we need to give them credits. And then Washington basically said, oh no, let them crash. We're happy to see them go down. And Jeff Sachs, you know, he was like, you're crazy, you can't do that. So what I want to say is, like, you're insiders, like Doug McGregor. They're insiders. Nobody has to explain to Doug McGregor, you know, how to run the tank. And so these insiders now go outside and talk to people directly. So I applaud you for that.
You're very kind to say that. Hey, I want to show you a map that the Defense Department, apparently not too far here, somewhere in Moscow, I don't know where the hell it is, But they just put out a new map that pretty much shows what Russia considers to be its brand new territory. It's funny that they put it out the day after Mr. Trump said that the Ukrainians are going to take all this territory back. But look at this. You can't see it, but I'll describe it. It basically shows Luhansk, you know, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. And it shows the new area even beyond that. And I think what they're trying to say is, look, I think what the Russians are trying to say is, this is Russian territory. It was Russian territory. It's going to be Russian territory again. And we're still gaining until somebody comes up with a reason for us to stop fighting. And unfortunately, the Europeans don't seem to want to give the Russians a reason to stop fighting. So I heard McGregor say this morning that he thinks if they don't give him a reason to stop, they're going to continue on to Odessa. What do you make of that?
I mean, if they continue on to Odessa, then Ukraine doesn't have access to the Black Sea anymore. I mean, that's a real threat to Ukraine. So, you know, if I was Zelensky, I would you know, start declaring now. You can keep Crimea, you can keep Donetsk, Luhansk, you can keep Kherson, Zaporizhia. You can. I promise that I will not join NATO, but please leave me access to the Black Sea. And that would be, I think, a sensible proposition. But somehow he's also trapped in his old narrative of, like, I will reconquer Crimea and I will reconquer. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So that, I think that's totally delusional. But, you know, we also have this question here in the West that at the time when Joe Biden allowed Zelensky to fire attack missiles into Russia, at that time, we now know that Joe Biden, that was at the end of 2024,
yes.
Joe Biden was not in, you know, in, well, how should I phrase it? He was not healthy, okay?
Yeah,
he was
right.
He was not right in his head.
Mm-hmm.
So the question obviously is, who at the end of 2024 gave this the right to the Ukrainians to actually fire weapons, American weapons, into Russian territory and kill Russian soldiers in Russia? Because that was a very, very dangerous moment. And we know that Task Force Dragon was this unit in the Clay Kaserne in Wiesbaden in Germany. They coordinated everything. That was a good article in the New York Times on the secret history of the war in Ukraine. But also, this does not get a lot of attention, I'm afraid, in Switzerland and Germany.
So who do you think? I like where you're going here. Don't stop. Who do you think, if Mr. Biden didn't have the mental capacity to actually make that decision, who do you think made that decision?
Maybe Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor,
yeah.
But you know, I don't know really. I just don't think that Joe Biden had any grasp of it on anything in at the end of 2024. We always have, you know, there's obviously books coming out on how his illness, you know, developed and everything. But the consensus is that by the end of his term, so actually in 2024, when he had the public debates with Donald Trump, I mean, everybody, even Clooney, George Clooney, who's a famous actor, you know, when he organized an event to support Joe Biden, and, you know, Joe Biden didn't recognize George Clooney. If you don't recognize George Clooney, you're in serious trouble, aren't you? It's like if you... So I think the people who are behind the scenes actually decided this. And if I may say so, we have US is a superpower, China is a superpower, Russia is a superpower. So these are the three giants. We have 193 countries in the world, but these are giants. There's no paper tiger among these three. There's no paper tiger. Like Russia has 6,000 nuclear weapons. The US has 6,000 nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So all we want is that we don't have an escalation between these big, big superpowers. We just don't want that. Nobody wants that. It's not about Putin. It's not about Trump. It's about humanity, you know, in the end. We just don't want that. And so the idea of the Americans to fire attack missiles into Russia at the end of 2024... This was reckless. This was more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And historians still today are not aware of it. Most are not aware of Task Force Dragon. But we know now that General Chris Donahue was actually the head of the task force. And, you know, he was giving Ukrainian generals the data where to, you know, where to shoot Russians. And in the beginnings, they were just shooting Russians who had invaded Ukraine. So he was just giving them the GPS data. And the Ukrainians were asking, how do we know that these are good points to shoot at? Because obviously, you know, this is a far distance shooting. Yeah, it's not you see your enemy. And then General Donahue, U.S. general in Germany, stationed in Germany, he said, you know, trust us and you'll be happy. And that at one point, something terrible happened. Donahue said, oh, I'm a U.S. general based here in Germany. Why don't we shoot Russians in Russia? Because they're coming across the border next day anyway. It's better to kill them back home. And then he gave the data to Ukrainian generals to shoot with American weapons, also HIMARS and the TACMs, different weapon systems, but really to shoot for the first time into Russia. And this was confirmed by the New York Times. You know, people go, oh, it's going to be a conspiracy theory. No, 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 that's confirmed by the New York Times. And the New York Times then just reported Joe Biden, you know, said that it's okay. But at that time, if I may point out, Joe Biden was not able to decide anything. So strange situation back then.
Makes you wonder how it is that Russia was able to, I suppose, control itself, control its hardliners, because there's hardliners here just like there are anywhere else, going, to hell with them. They're going to do that to us. We're going to do it to them. And that would have started World War III.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I mean. I studied the Cuban Missile Crisis. And at the time, President Kennedy really had to control, you know, Curtis LeMay and other from the Air Force who said, now we just have to bomb Cuba. And that would have, you know, been a disaster. And the same restraint is really something I applaud Putin for, because what Putin then did is he fired an Oreshnik missile that, you know, he had to give an answer in some form. And he fired an Oreshnik missile into Ukraine and just, you know, showed everybody, I can hit Berlin, I can hit Paris, I can hit London, and you can do nothing. You can do nothing. And I think, you know, everybody calmed down a little bit at that point. But the restraint that the Russians showed was important. Also for Russia, you know, it's not in the interest of Russia to pick a fight with all of NATO. So really, I hope that there are people in the United States who show restraint. There are obviously people in Ukraine as well who say, you know, we shouldn't kill Russians in Russia with American-made missiles based on GPS data from U.S. generals in Germany. I mean, we are the ones who in the end will lose part of our country. We will lose a whole generation of young men. And our cities, if we just continue, will be devastated, because there really is a way out. And the way out, and I've said this for many, many months and years, and I'm in agreement with Mersheimer, Jeffrey Sachs, and Doug McGregor, that Ukraine has to become a neutral country. I'm in Switzerland. Yes. Switzerland is a neutral country. Austria is a neutral country.
Yes.
Ireland is a neutral country. Sweden and Finland, unfortunately, they you know, they joined NATO. I think big mistake, but, you know, that's theirs. But Ukraine should become a neutral country. First step, it's not complicated, just this first step. And the second step should be leave the territory to the Russians, which they conquered. And this is something which is easily accomplished. You can say, okay, you keep Crimea, because the Russians will never give Sevastopol to the Americans or to NATO. That, you know, that's a no-brainer. And the Donbass, Donetsk, Luhansk, just give it to the Russians and stop it there. And the benefit for Ukraine then is that they have more young men to rebuild their country.
Yes.
Because if you send all your young men, and with young men, I mean the men with 25 years of age, they're the powerful guys, not the 70 or the 90-year-old guys. So if you send them to the front and they get killed, you don't have the population to rebuild your country with. So I think peace is possible. But Trump at the United Nations, as far as I'm concerned, didn't make any good suggestions. He should have said, you know, Ukraine should be a neutral country, full stop. He had the world listening to him. He had all the world leaders together, and it would have been a bold statement. It would have been a brave statement.
You're right. You're right. But, you know, Daniel, I think he also feels pressure still from within the same people who pressured every other president before him, including him, to say something which is close to what the Europeans want to hear. Let me end with this, though. I was just thinking about this as I was listening to you, because you were talking about how close we came to World War III during that time when Mr. Biden was president. And you really had the forces of the West and of the United States and all the power of the United States and its nuclear might facing down and threatening Russia. Since then, things have changed. What we saw recently as a result of what Mr. Trump did to India, especially, what we saw recently at the Shanghai Cooperative Summit, I thought was fascinating because it was a real show of force. Where now we see India, China, Russia, Egypt, UAE, who am I missing? Brazil, hell, Turkey, Slovakia, all in one room saying, hey, we've got a new coalition here now, and we're as big or bigger than the coalition that used to scare us. Have we just seen a didactic change in our planet as a result of this very powerful force?
Yes, we do. I mean, check the data. We have NATO led by the United States. That's 13-2 countries. 32 sounds like a big number, but keep in mind it's 193 countries in the world. So 30 is just a part of it. And then we have 10 BRIC countries, Russia, obviously, then China, India, South Africa, Brazil, etc. But if you take China and India together, 1.4 billion in China, 1.4 billion in India, that's 2.8 billion. Brazil is 200 million. So that's already 3 billion. And all of NATO is just 1 billion. So you have 3 billion here and 1 billion here. So at that point, NATO countries, and obviously I'm in Switzerland, we're just 8 million people. We have to watch here and there, up and down, everywhere. We speak different languages. We really have to keep the mind going, because it's obvious that America made a big, big strategic mistake. They forced Russia and China together.
Yes.
You know, Brzezinski always said, yeah, they'll never go together. Brzezinski's wrong.
Yeah.
This war in Ukraine has, and also the blowing up of Nord Stream pipeline, as Seymour Hersh said, by Joe Biden and the CIA. So all of this has led Russia to go close and closer with Xi Jinping of China. And obviously the Chinese are a very strong nation. So actually the US has two big enemies or big rivals, which is Russia and China. And what they've done is unite the enemies. I mean, this is just stupid. Yeah.
India, China, Russia, together, shaking hands, slapping each other's backs. It was amazing. By the way, you just reminded me, because I like you, I've been doing this for an awful long time. And you just mentioned Brzezinski, and I remember it was fascinating, because Seymour is great. I love Seymour, and I've interviewed obviously. And he called me when he had the scoop on Nord Stream, and he came on and did the interview with me. And those of you who want to find it, just go to Journalistically Speaking, my podcast.
And thanks that you spoke to Seymour Hersh, because he had a hard time publishing his piece. I mean, that's crazy. So that you see how difficult it is to publish real journalism in the West. Yeah, but continue.
Putting him on the air was huge for him and for me, for us at the time, because it was important to tell that story. But when it comes to Brzezinski, it was funny because he used to come on my show from time to time. And I will say this, and God bless him, I know he's passed on now, but he was a bit of a jerk. And if you didn't agree or want to talk about the things that he wanted to talk about, then he was not going to cooperate. And on my final interview with him, I was at CNN. And I was going to have him on as my guest. And I had told my booker to tell him that I didn't want him to suggest something, because if he did, it would be fine, of course, but I was going to challenge him on it. So he took off his microphone and walked off the set.
He did.
Just, it was, yeah, like,
I mean this, but then you remember the time in 1997 when he published his book, The Grand Chessboard. And really the most important argument in the book is, the United States, can break Ukraine away and take it into NATO. I mean, this is his thinking. And now we have to come to the point that is absolutely wrong.
He was wrong.
He was wrong.
Yes.
I mean, he was big time wrong. And now we see that everything unfolds in a different way. And it's like a game of chess when you think, oh, he's a very smart man, I just do whatever he says. And then you see, oh, I did everything Brzezinski said, and now it's messed up.
Yeah.
I think George Kennan was much better. George Kennan at the time said NATO expansion will lead to a reaction by Russia, and that will be a defeat for NATO. I mean, George Kennan understood the situation much, much better.
The neocons.
And today, I think Mearsheimer is very good. John Mearsheimer is spot on.
Yeah.
He says, come on, you unite both your enemies. How clever is that?
The neocons and the interventionists have been wrong across the board. Iraq, Afghanistan, Belgrade, yep. Ukraine, Syria, Libya. I mean,
it's a long list, isn't it?
You just go down the list. You really do. You are a delight to talk to. Daniel, you really are. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
How can people read you, hear you, get hold of you? Please share whatever you want so our millions of viewers all over the world can get to know you better.
Well, I wrote this book, Ruthless Empire. It's about the United States. So it goes back to the time when the Spanish were still ruling Cuba. It takes in the Vietnam War. I also question 9/11 for those who are interested in that. And I do the Syria War, Iraq, Afghanistan. And that's my book, Ruthless Empire. Those who want to find it, or they find me on YouTube. Find me on YouTube. And it was a pleasure talking to you, and really want to say I really try. I'm here in Switzerland. You're in Russia. I really try to bring the German-speaking world and the Russian world together. And it's not good to have Germany and Russia in a fight. You know, we've had Hitler and we have had Napoleon. We don't need it again. We should really transcend this area and come to just, friendship and economic relationship, which is trade, and that's it. We don't have to kill each other.
No, listen, those people behind me, I mean, I'm new here. I've only been here a few months. I'm not an expert on them. But I spend a lot of time with them, because in Moscow, you spend a lot of time on the streets. It's a very European city. They're not hateful people. They don't go around telling me that I'm a bad person because I'm American, because of what Trump said. They don't go around saying Germans are bad. They don't hate the UK. They don't they don't dislike Europeans. I wish I could say the same thing. It's the other way around, but it is what it is.
It's in the NATO countries. The hate is in the NATO countries a bit bigger, but I do work in Germany a lot. Like, I gave talks last week in Germany, and like 1,000 people coming to one talk, and then I go to the next city, is another 1,000 people, and then a third city is another 1,000 people. So I work a lot, I go out, and just if I may say one thing to conclude on the German population, those who come to my talks, they say, we don't want that. Our government is mad. They increase military spending, and we don't have any money left. And they, if we switch on television, it's just Russia hating. We can't listen to it anymore. So there's a lot of people in Germany as well who really love Russia and who want to have peace. They just happen to have a complicated situation with their own government and with their television stations.
Yeah, no, that's well stated. And it seems to be the scenario all over the world in many ways. So, but what? All we can do is speak the truth. And hopefully, eventually, it will cut through. Daniel, thanks again. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And the next time that you guys at home are going to be seeing me, I will not be here. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be in Sochi. They have this thing every year called an event for intellectuals, believe it or not. And I don't know, somebody there decided to invite me. They must be drunk or something. I apologize. But nonetheless, we're going to be reporting to you from Sochi, where I'm going to be doing some segments. I'm going to be bringing our show from there as well. So you'll be seeing the Sanchez effect right there from Sochi at this special event that we have every year. You could see some of what we do on Journalistically Speaking as well. on YouTube as well at Rick Sanchez TV. I'll be looking for you. Thanks so much for being with us, and thank you for allowing us into your homes.